Emmy Cricket Show number 177. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
02088 167 691,
and you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Welcome along, Garrows and Berners. I'm sporting a very fetching beard this week. That's the big news.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I think it probably was because I said to my team I wouldn't shave until we won, and we lost our last game, so that's it now. I've got six months. I've got 6 months of growth now. I'm going to look like Karl Marx at the end of it.
Look like Ian Beale.
I've got more of a Matthew Pryor look going on myself.
Well, yeah, it's the lack of hair, isn't it?
Yep.
So anyway, let's talk about cricket. So India did the job in the under-19s tournament. We saw an article on Cricket Info this week that was saying that it was all down to excellent preparation. The two best prepared teams got to the final. They do seem to have done a lot of work, the Indian under-19s, to get ready for this tournament. A lot of touring, a lot of games at home, and a big camp before the event. So, Gary, is it as simple as that? Is it preparation is the key to India's success at under-19 level?
I think it's played a part, and all of the teams were prepared as well as they possibly could. But the thing that's impressed me about India is the way they've counteracted the bouncing ball in the games that I watched, and I watched quite a few of them. The ball bounced pretty high, and that's been a problem for the Indian teams when they've toured overseas previously. So their preparations have been spot on in relation to coping with that bouncing ball and getting the results from their batters that they needed to win the tournament. So whether they prepared any better than anybody else or put more money in or whatever, I don't know. But one of the advantages the subcontinent teams do have is that they have the opportunity to play lots of cricket, because obviously there's India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Pakistan and other teams around them that they can play against on a regular basis, which is probably different to the likes of Australia and England, for example, that there's significant travel involved with playing a lot of under-19 matches. So that's probably the difference. But the counteract and the bouncing ball was a big thing for me.
Did you manage to catch any of the competition, Berners?
A little bit. I know that the Indian captain got a lot of press, didn't he, with his batting.
But it was the Indian batsman that made the difference in the long run in that tournament.
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, the captain's taken a lot of good press and did look a cut above. And it was his control and then just his calculated hitting. But when he hit the ball, you know, he was hitting the ball 10 rows back. When he made the choice to really go big, and it was that innings in the final, I thought the way he paced it, and there was only probably one false shot that he played when they were sort of 60 down to winning the match. He played one false shot and then railed himself back in and finished the game off. Looks a good quality player, and with the guys beginning to finish in that Indian team, it shouldn't be too long before we see him in one day internationals and then test matches.
Yes, and of course they're getting exposure at IPL level as well, aren't they? Of course, the Indians. So that's when you're around players of such a high standard when you're 18, 19 years old. That's got to help your game, hasn't it?
Big time. And you know, it was one of the reasons why the IPL was set up in the way that it was, to ensure that it wasn't just about people coming in for payday, but it was about the development of young Indian cricketers. And the way that they structured their teams in the initial editions of the IPL was very pro young player, and it's obviously beginning to pay off. And when you see guys come through like that, there's no reason why they can't make the of Brett Lee and others over the course of the last three or four editions of the IPL.
Berners, you had a little bit of follow-up from the previous week, something about a dead ball that we were discussing last week that didn't make it into the show. So what was that about? When does the ball go dead? Something to do with stumpings, I think.
Yeah, there was an issue in the test match, actually, when Pryor, I think, dismissed AB de Villiers. He just slightly overbalanced, but after you know, slightly longer than a routine stumping would take place. So it was a bit of a, there was a bit of questioning and umming in the commentary box, and I think generally in the world of cricket, people started to ask a few questions just about, well, hang on a minute, how long can you actually, you know, hold the ball before you actually go ahead and take someone's bails off? So it was just quite an interesting talking point, really.
Yeah, because you can't stand around forever, can you? And wait for the batsman to wander down the pitch. But it's yeah, it's a bit of a grey area, isn't it? Because we had to look that one up, and you know, there's all the normal things about the ball going dead when, you know, there's a boundary score, a wicket falls, or if it gets trapped in the clothing of the batsman, things like that. But yeah, it doesn't specifically mention that situation. And there is a kind of an overarching law which says the ball's dead when everybody thinks it's dead.
I mean, there was, you're in the predicament in that scenario where the player was clearly, he wasn't balanced. And the keeper knew that. So he knew at some stage he had to transfer weight, which was inevitably going to lift his foot. Yeah. So it was quite smart by the wicketkeeper. But then as a batsman, you know, how, I guess it's a battle of the fittest, how long he can compose himself in that position without toppling over, knowing that the wicketkeeper's not throwing the ball to first slip and he's about to dislodge your bails, which some could say possibly could fringe on the border of unsporting conduct, whereby, you know, okay, he's got back, he's not balanced, he's got to shift his position to actually take guard again.
Do you know what? I never used to hold onto the ball bloody long enough, I don't think. You know, I'd either whip the bails off or chuck it off to point or something like that. I just think, you know, common sense needs to prevail, really. And especially in the game and the world that we're living at the moment, people want instant results, don't they? So, you know, unless there's a genuine stumping on offer, and then, you know, get the bails off and then chuck the ball away, as far as I'm concerned. You know, if somebody topples over after 10 seconds or something like that, well, you know, so be it. You know, but the ball should be dead, I think, within a couple of seconds, really.
Because there's always that, I think, as well, what's changed it is the fact that a lot of the video reviews now, they're often deemed out by the foot being in the air, not necessarily being back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very hard to determine from square leg without like, I don't think this would apply so much in, say, club cricket. I think it's more at the top level where they know that as soon as that, if they get their timing right, it's going to get reviewed and it's going to be in the air and he's going to be given out. Whereas to see that with the naked eye is actually pretty hard, as you would probably know, Gareth, having been a stumper all your life.
Yeah, definitely. And it is hard. And that's why they should always get given that out, I think, as much as I used to dispute that hugely when I was playing club cricket. I think it's only sensible that it is not out.
I think the club equivalent of that is the batsman who reaches well forward and he's toppling and he just completely falls over. And he can't get his, that's the only way you're going to get it, because that foot going up for a second and back down again, you have to have a pretty sharp sharp-eyed umpire to see that. And I've had many where I thought it was probably out, but then I was right next to it. But when you think how, you know, the umpire's 20 yards away, he's probably not going to see that. So, you know, you can't complain too much about it.
Having watched quite a bit of cricket this summer, the number of times the player goes down the pitch, he kind of then slides his back foot back to try and get over the line, but his studs almost just kept caught, like he gets caught short by his studded footwear, and his stud or the very tip of his toe of his shoe is actually on the line. So he's back, thinking he's back, but he's never actually crossed the line. So the whole time he's holding the pose, he's actually out the whole time.
Yeah.
Without, you know, in his mind, in his mindset, he's made it back, but he's at no stage has he actually crossed the line to get back in.
Yeah, the line is the keeper's or the umpire's, depending on whose side you're on, I suppose.
Yeah, which, seeing again from square leg with a guy who's probably, you know, semi-drunk on a Saturday afternoon, you know, you would question whether it's got too much weight in the amateur game. But certainly that video replay does add a massive difference to guys at the top.
And the other thing I wanted to get on with this week, just moving on quickly, is that we had quite a good question come through regarding different coaching structures in different countries and how you can try and sort of use the good of both of them And the question's from a chap called Jeremy, who said he lives in the Middle East, and he feels like his son is missing out on the more established structure that's in the UK. Despite efforts to have players seen by counties in summer holidays, it's not realistic to parachute them into an ongoing year-long structure in the UK. And in any case, the summer represents off-season time for lads when they're well advised to rest and work on core strength and conditioning issues. So, what he's saying is, what are the relative merits of these different pathways? If you are in the UAE and you're lucky enough to be able to, put someone into a private school, say, for the summer, for the UAE summer, which would be our winter, then is that a good thing to do? Or how do those structure? What's the best thing to do in that situation? So I thought, Gareth, you might be in a good position, being in a Millfield, to talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I'm going to know a lot more about the UAE come December because we're actually touring there. We're taking two sides over to the UAE to play for 3 weeks or a couple of weeks, and I'm very much looking forward to it. So I can't really comment so much on their structures. I think it's one of the challenges for any associate nation is that there isn't necessarily a first-class structure or a test team or an ODI team that's playing on a regular basis for players to progress to, and that in itself is the biggest challenge because there's not so much competition and people can't necessarily prove themselves, and that's one of the reasons why Ireland that I worked for a number of years are trying to build their own first-class structure to try and retain their players, but also to develop their players so they can continue to develop rather than reaching a ceiling and having to look for somewhere else to play their cricket in order to keep developing. So that's a challenge for associate cricket presently is having an outlet for the most talented players and a pathway for people to develop to and continue to go up because there's always a bit of a ceiling. Whereas obviously in our own structure in England presently, you've got academies which lead to first-class cricket, which lead to England development programs and Lions programs and first-class cricket and Test cricket. Whereas that isn't the case in the UAE. They play in the qualifying tournaments for World Cup spots, and that's the same level as Ireland are presently. But Ireland are trying to go beyond that for the benefit of their cricketers. So it's a really tricky one, and that's why you see so many players. Somebody like the guys come over from Denmark a few years ago and came and played in county cricket and then went for playing for England. You get people coming from all sorts of places to play for England, but ultimately you want your own structure within your country to be able to support the most talented players. And as I say, I'll be able to comment more on UAE once I've been out there and spend a little bit more time around it. But so that is the challenge for associate cricket.
Okay, well, we whipped through that one, Jeremy. Hope that gives you a bit more of an insight into thinking about what's happening with your son and the young players around his age. But, Berners, we're going to move into the yes no round. So, you've got the questions there, haven't you? And what we do every week is we have a round of three questions where we can only answer yes or no, me and Gareth, and Berners is the question master. So, let's get cracking, Berners. What are the three questions this week?
First question this week is classy looking batsmen are more likely to get picked.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question, batsmen are allowed to run again if the ball ricochets off of them when attempting a run.
Yes.
No.
Indian fielding will improve with the retirement of older players.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so we had a little preview question in the introduction this week, but this is the proper questions section. We've got our mailbag at the ready, and of course, every week we answer two questions, the best of which wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And Berners, you've got those questions as well, so fire away.
I do. First question comes in from Jeremy, and he's had the recent experience of working with Cricket Australia, or certainly being having some exposure with their coaching setup, and he was amazed by the almost complete focus on implicit coaching. And he says that he can understand the benefits for more established cricketers, and coaching young lads from scratch is extremely difficult without a certain amount of explicit instruction. What is our view? And he also asked, what's the balance in terms of this?
So just to clarify the difference between implicit and explicit, as far as I'm aware anyway, implicit is coaching where you don't necessarily tell someone exactly what to do. You give them a task, something to complete, and then they kind of work it out for themselves. Whereas with explicit instruction, explicit coaching, you actually tell them how to play the cover drive so they can hit the ball through extra cover if they want to, or you know, whatever the bowling action or anything. And I would say that it's a little bit of a moot point, in that if you wanted to put a screw into the wall, then you wouldn't necessarily grab a hammer from the toolbox. First of all, you probably grab a screwdriver, because that's the most suitable tool for the job. And they're two different tools, and they have different places. And sometimes you want to use one tool, and sometimes you want to use the other tool. But if you put them up against each other, if you make it a competition and say, this is the way that you should be doing everything, then you're kind of missing the point slightly, in that, yeah, sometimes you do want to do some more technical stuff and get something, some particular technical point that you want to work. Say with a young player, there's nothing wrong with showing them how to hold a cricket bat, for example, or when they're bowling, how to hold a cricket ball. That's quite a sensible thing to do. But also a sensible thing to do is, instead of teaching them for a long time the techniques of playing a straight drive, you can put down two cones and tell them to try and hit the ball between those two cones and see if they can suss it out for themselves. So different tools for different occasions.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. I think that the general way of thinking is that you're more explicit at the younger age groups, and as a player matures, and when I say mature, I don't just mean in age, but also their level, their ability and their experiences that they have as they go up the player pathway, then you ask more questions, and then you open things up a little bit more, and give them more latitude to develop their own game through self-learning. There's also a counter argument that says that people learn best through playing games, and rather than having explicit coaching and this is how you play a cover drive, as you just explained. And I spent a lot of time around a guy called Rod Thorpe at Loughborough University, who devised a concept called Games for Understanding, teaching games for understanding. So I'm a big fan of that. But again, as you say, it's a toolbox that you have, and you pull it out as and when that particular tool that you want to use. And I find myself increasingly using some really good benchmark stuff that I got through my time with England, and showing people how the best players in the world do it, and then letting them go really and finding their own way within those parameters. And so there's a sort of balance between showing them a Ricky Ponting playing various shots, and then them finding their own way of how they would do it with a slight slant and putting their own personality on it. There's a bit of both. I'm interested in the view that Australian cricket has gone very much towards the implicit way of coaching, because that is a stark contrast to where they were 15 years ago with their coaching program. And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer. I think the best coaches do bits of both, from what I've seen. And if you can practice both skills, it's only going to give you more resources to be able to pick and as and when, as you say. So interesting to hear the view of Cricket Australia's coaching program at the moment. Yeah. Whether it's an accurate one or not, I don't know, but certainly that was the experience of the person that wrote the question in.
Maybe he was watching the first team.
Well, I mean, it really is an interesting. I talked to you about some explicit coaching that we had to do at England level. Actually, we had a pretty poor ODI side in 2006, but it was a young side, and it was a side that had only just come together. And we had a couple of games, then we got up to Old Trafford, and the game got rained off. I think we played on a reserve day, but I'd put together some video of our batting. And it was evident that when the ball was being hit out to deep mid on, and there was a deep mid on and deep mid off on in place, and nobody up in the circle, the guy, a batter, was beating the bowler, and yet the non-striker was turning around to see where the mid-on and mid-off was. You know, so therefore wasting time and potentially missing out on twos because they're checking to see where the guy is. Whereas if they were aware of it, and then as soon as the ball goes past them, they can hair up and turn back and at least look for the two. And so even at that level, we were doing some fairly explicit coaching around what many of us would consider to be an elementary area of the game. But I remember Duncan Fletcher, Matthew Maynard and myself coaching two or three of the England players at that time in, you know, be aware of where the fielders are, and then you can get up and back and put people under pressure as opposed to turning around and having a look. You know,
so
which
teaching an international player how to run between the wicket is what you're trying to tell us.
Well, mate, absolutely right. And I think it was a little bit around where county cricket was at that point. And county cricket, to me, has moved on significantly in the way it's been coached since even 2006. And I think, you know, the IPL coming about and people watching cricket all the way around the year. And instead of being in your bubble, you're actually looking at the games from all over the world, and things start to drip feed themselves into your head. And you don't have so many of those conversations. And I think the academies are doing a good job, and people are just more aware of the out cricket elements of cricket. But we found for a very short period of time that actually we were inheriting cricketers into the England setup, new cricketers into the England setup, that weren't particularly cricket savvy. And streetwise, as Fletch would call them, and it was disappointing that that was happening. But that was, you know, an example of us talking to people about basic cricket, or what most of us would consider basic cricket, that was obviously being missed out somewhere along the line.
The next question is in from Tom, and he's a leg spinner, and he's saying he gets nice drift and dip when he bowls the ball, and he's got a good pivot, but he just doesn't seem to get much turn. Saying he gets decent revs on the ball, and he uses the old Shane Warne strategy of two fingers up, two fingers down to grip it and rip it, and he rips off his third finger. He's also watched all of the videos, and he just cannot understand how Shane Warne spun it so much. He finishes by an absolute classic, which pretty much makes my week, which says his stock ball pitches on off and misses off. Can we help him out?
Yeah. Well, firstly, if your ball pitches on off and misses off and it's turning, the angles of that are significant. So you are making the ball break off of the wicket, if that is the case. So congratulations on that. The second thing I'd say is that the ball spin comes about, and the physics of a ball spinning comes about as a result of having revolutions on the ball, which is something you've identified that you've got in place presently, which is great. The other thing is that the ball landing on the pitch with the appropriate seam angle, so the seam digs into the pitch and has the most contact with the pitch to get that break coming out of it. And thirdly, it's the pace. So if you are getting revs, then it's one of the other two that is limiting you presently. So I'd suggest have a look at how your seam's landing up against the pitch, and also have a look at the pace of the ball going onto the pitch.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, if it's turning half the bat's width, that's all you really need. So I was thinking, he's presented his problem as I'm not getting much turn, but I'm wondering if he means I'm not beating the bat much, or they're not nicking off much. Or you know, they're driving me through the covers easily, and I'm not getting the wickets. So I'm just trying to extrapolate his question out a little bit to think what is the real problem here? Because if it sounds like he is getting turned, what is the real problem? So I was thinking maybe one of two things, because he's quite young, Tom. So one thing I was thinking is maybe he's throwing up a little bit too much. But you were saying there that his pace is sometimes you can bowl a bit too quick. Obviously we're guessing here, but my guess maybe is that if he's throwing up a bit too much, then it gives the batsman time to be able to defeat the amount of turn that he's getting, because they can get to the pitch of the ball more easily. Or he's just impatient.
Or maybe just wants to bowl a 3.5 meter spinning delivery, which is great, and you know. But
it is a good aim, yeah.
But just remember that Shane Warne didn't bowl those.
Yeah, I mean, those ones that turned a mile didn't happen that often, did they?
No, and that's part of the art, isn't it? And he, I mean, he was absolutely brilliant, and a great bowler. What, if not the best? I should imagine. Many people would be saying that at home. But even his biggest spinning delivery, say the Gatting ball, that would come out very, very, very rarely. And that's a huge spinning delivery. And I mean, it's pitched just outside leg and hit the top of off. That's a massive amount of spin. But actually, if you looked at all of his, 700, 800 wickets, whatever he got, most of them would have been little bits of spin, and certainly similar amounts of spin as Tom has described to us, with the ball pitching on off and spinning and missing off stump. That's a good enough ball in itself, and I think your point's a really good one, David, in that it would be interesting to know more about his pace. So if his pace is slow and people are able to counteract the spin and almost be defeated once, but have enough time to be able to get bat on it or to score runs off it, or in fact, if he has got great revolutions on the ball and he's actually could spin the ball even more if he actually slowed the ball up. So more information, Tom, needed, I think.
Yeah, Tom, get back in touch with us. I know you are a listener to the show, so get back in touch with us. You have our Twitter account at PV Cricket Coach. So let us know a bit more detail about how quickly you're bowling and how that problem is manifesting itself. Is it you're getting a bit of tonk and not getting enough wickets? The other thing I was thinking about was accuracy as well. I know with a leg spin it's hard. But if you're bowling a couple of poor balls and over, then you can easily get frustrated by just getting hit around more easily than you would hope. So maybe there's something there as well. But yeah, Tom, get back in touch with us. Let us know.
Now it's time for the part of a show where one of us gets up on the soapbox and has a little rant and rave for no more than a minute. And this week, it's David's turn.
There's a lot of creative shots around nowadays, and I was at an under 14 2020 tournament recently, and I was watching a young player who's only 14 years old, but he was absolutely tearing it up. He scored a brilliant 90 odd, I think it was 95, possibly 97, and he completely showed up the bowlers. But he got himself out within one shot of 100 by trying to play a reverse sweep when there was a fielder in position for that exact shot. So just because you can play those shots, even if you're well in and creaming it all over the place, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to. Sometimes you have to think about it a little bit more and decide if you are going to play those shots by looking at the field and thinking, okay, there's a gap there, I can use that shot. And if there isn't a gap there, then perhaps you just keep that one in the locker and hit it straight back over the bowler's head and get your 100 instead. And so that is the end of this week's show. We got some follow-up for next week, hopefully. If Tom's listening, then we will have some follow-up. But that's the end of this week's show. But before we go, we need to decide who the winner is this week. So we had two questions, and the best question wins the prize, which is the online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. Jeremy's coaching setup question and Tom's spin bowling question. Gareth, which was the best?
Well, I'm hoping that Tom writes in again and has another opportunity to win the prize. So I'm going to go with the coaching structure. I thought it was a great question about implicit and explicit learning and implicit and explicit questioning styles and the way that we coach. So that's my winner for this week. And I encourage Tom to give us a follow up, give us a bit more information and have another chance of winning it in future weeks.
Congratulations, Jeremy. And your prize is an online coaching course, so you can pick the one you want, and we will give it to you without you having to pay a penny. If you want to send in your own question, you can do so. And Bernice, you've got the details there.
Yep, give us a call 020-8817-691, or drop us a mail coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, and you can get us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at PV Cricket Coach, and you can find us on Facebook if you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. It's facebook.com/Pitch Vision Academy. You can also subscribe to the show if you want to listen every week, and just head over to iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us there. Or if you prefer, go on to pitchvision.com/Academy, click on the podcast link, and all the details on how to use the RSS feed are there if you want. Have we got a tail ender this week?
I've got one from a commentator's perspective. As one I heard Butcher say, he goes, watch all the buzzers go up, and like when something goes against you, all the hands go onto the head and onto the hips, calling them buzzers.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I heard that as well, actually.
That's a different buzzer from last time.
Yeah, it's a different buzzer. It's not an overthrow buzzer.
It's everybody getting frustrated. The teapots and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Seriously hacked off, the whole world against us.
The hat throw and everything.
Yeah.
Hat throw, stomp, ground kick.
So, if you're frustrated, there's your tail ender for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Bernice.
Cheers, Coach.
Cheers, guys.